Well, hello, everyone, and welcome into the Fun and Then Some podcast here. Fun 92.7 bringing it to you your way. Michael St. John, of course, Adam Ward sitting in the driver's seat today. Looking forward to a great show with you. We thank you for tuning in wherever you might be tuning in from, whether you're listening in the car, maybe you're on your way to work or the kids' ball game, or maybe you're just sitting at home looking for something to tune into. We appreciate you tuning in, or maybe even you're just sitting on the toilet and found us on the toilet. One way or the other, as long as we're not in the toilet and we're on your phone, that's great. So thanks again for tuning in to the Fun and Then Some podcast, episode number 3, Michael. I feel like we're sort of getting our legs on with this finally.
Or our seats under us, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you said that, the first thing that came to mind, and you're going to love this, is Ronnie Shumate listening to our podcast when he's taking care of business. It's a terrible sight for anybody to see or even think about. But, toward the end of February, weather is up and down on the roller coaster that February always is. You know, they say the black lady that used to work for my mama and daddy and my grandpa, Miss Mandy, God love her soul, she used to say, "Mr. Michael, you get through January's and the February's and you march right on." And I hope she's right.
I hope so.
It's been a lousy February around here, let me tell you.
It has been. All we've had is rain, rain, and more rain. And, of course, I've heard enough about building the ark jokes. I've heard enough of those jokes already.
It's crazy.
And it just doesn't seem like it ends around here. But, again, like you said, we're coming to you live from the heart of Alabama, folks. So this place, we know how to get every season in a week.
Well, the thing is, they say about the South, if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes and it'll change. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we've had just about on a daily basis for the last few weeks. But hopefully things will get I saw a sign of early spring last week. I was in Tennessee on Tuesday and Wednesday, I think, or Wednesday and Thursday. Wednesday, Thursday. And on my way up on Wednesday, I saw a ton of what is called jonquils, which are the little yellow flowers.
Yeah.
And little white ones. And saw so many of them. And that, along with robins in your front yard, when you see a bird, the robin redbreast in your front yard, it's a sign of spring. And robins have been all over the house. I mean, all over the front of our house, all over the backyard. We've seen a ton of robins over the past, since Melanie June's birthday on the 14th. And now the yellow jonquils, but the problem is when the cold weather snaps, those jonquils go, they go like Ronnie Shumate. They go,
yeah.
And anyway, I've had the two Ronnie Shumate references already in this podcast. That can't be a good sign.
Mm-mm.
But anyway,
we're going to start paying him for that.
Early spring, and of course, daylight savings time comes back to play on March 11th?
I think that's right.
No, March 8th. March 8th.
Yeah, we're like, from the time of this taping, we're like less than 2 weeks away.
Oh, wait, okay. It's not this weekend.
No. It'll be...
next podcast.
It'll be the 7th into the 8th. It'll be that Sunday morning, that March 8th at like 2 a.m. or whatever time it is. We lose an hour because we spring forward, which is all well and good. It's going to be capping off a very, very busy week for me personally, and I'll end up losing an hour of sleep, so that just means I got to go to bed a little bit earlier. That'll be all right.
When it's daylight savings time, either the spring or the fall, do you set your clocks before you go to bed or when you get up in the morning?
I end up setting them when I get up, simply because I usually rely on this little thing, my phone right here, to wake me up, and it automatically changes. So I generally just don't even bother with it the night before, even though it does make me have to think and, okay, well, when I go to bed, I'm actually going to be, springing forward. I'll be losing an hour, so I've got to think. It really should feel from 11 o'clock, it should feel like midnight or whatever the case is if I'm up still. But I usually wait until later. What about you?
I actually, you know how anal I am. I actually set them before I go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been known, when Fun Radio once started back 22 years ago, going on 23 years ago, you would have to come up here at 2 o'clock in the morning because of the system that we had running the format.
Yeah.
You had to come up here at 2 o'clock in the morning and either move it forward or move it backward.
Make it change.
So you had to physically do it. So for many years I did that. And then of course, when, we've got the digital jukebox in hand, it does it on its own, which is good. But I normally change it before I go to bed.
Well, while we're talking about this, it brings up a good point. A lot of folks, and I think we're seeing it more today, especially in the last 5 years or so, being vocalized and people talking about it, and even politicians kind of getting in on the talk now about, should we get off of springing forward and falling back. Personally, I'd be a fan of staying in the springing forward and having more daylight. I don't know your feels on it. I mean, to me, I feel like I've seen a lot more people kind of go that way of let's not change twice a year. Let's just stick with one and leave it at that. What do you think?
I lived in a state that did that for 2 years in Arizona and loved it.
Yeah,
I did. You know, daylight savings time all came to be during World War II,
right?
For production purposes of armament. And it sort of hung around. It went away, then it came back after World War II. And I think it's been in place since 58 or 56. I forget what year it finally started. We did the spring forward, fall back thing. But, you know, the argument you get, and you get the argument with people that have small kids that go to school and may have to catch a school bus or whatever, that in the middle of December through, you know, the month of December, January, and into February, the kids are leaving for school in the dark. I think kids should be in school 24/7 from the time they're 6 years old until the time they're 18 anyway. And so, therefore, I don't buy the argument. I understand the argument. I don't buy the argument. And I think it's to the betterment of society. Forget the kids. Let's talk about the productivity part of it. And I think it would be best to have the time an hour sprung forward. Now, I didn't know this until several years ago, and we were doing some research about it. In fact, I was doing a little research about consulting a radio station up in St. John's Island in Canada. And I'd been contacted. There is a couple of time zones. You know, the world is broken up into 24 time zones circumference-wise. You start at Greenwich in England, and you go east, and that's where you start adding the hour. Okay, and this hour is, you know, it's 7 hours, six hours difference between here in New York and London. So when it's noon in New York, it's 6 o'clock in the evening in London, 5 o'clock in the evening in Belfast, Ireland, 4 o'clock in the evening in Iceland, and you come on across. And I'll get to New York and it's noon, you know, so, and it looks like a big globe cut into 24 pieces, like an orange, take an orange, 24 slices. And those are your time zones. There are two or three, and I forget how many now, time zones that are split by half hour.
Really?
In the world. And I didn't know that. And one of them affects not the Atlantic time zone, which is the one east of the Eastern time zone, but the one east of that. And I think it affects Greenland and part of the very tip end of northeast Canada. And it is actually a half hour change.
I had no idea.
I didn't either. And I started doing a little work with the station up there. And I was like, and I would call him at, you know, it'd be 2 o'clock our time saying, okay, it's 5 o'clock there or 4:30. Yeah, four. And it would be 4:30 there.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, it's like, 14 hours from, you know, or ahead of us in Australia or something like the 12, 14 hours are ahead of us. And
right.
It's daylight here and nighttime there.
And you got to realize the international dateline.
Yes.
Is right. It's west of the Hawaiian Islands by two time zones, I think.
Yeah.
But I know you go to Japan, like if these wrestlers or professional wrestlers will go over to Japan and you lose a day going over. Like if you leave today, which is we're doing this taping on a Tuesday, it's actually at 6 o'clock tonight. Our time will be midnight going into Thursday.
Right.
In Tokyo.
Right. Yeah.
And so you lose that. And then coming back, you get to repeat a day.
Yeah.
So, but anyway. All right.
Yeah. I get the whole time zone thing. I am not a big fan of switching it up. I personally prefer, you know, I leave the station somewhere between 5 and 6 o'clock most nights. I prefer not driving home in the dark if I don't have to. In particular, I have an hour's drive to get home.
And you have a lot of deer in the Lake Gunnersville State Park that are looking out for you.
Yes, they are, me specifically.
There's this car. Go for it.
There's a wanted sign with my picture on it, you know, with a big egg underneath it to symbol my car, just so they can understand it. Speaking of spring, let's move forward with another topic of conversation, one we have not discussed, and I am interested in your take on this, and I think you probably know where I'm going. Pitchers and catchers reported just a couple of 3 weeks ago, and then last week we all started, every major league team started their spring training games. And I think each one of them is like two games in. They'll play their third and fourth and even fifth ones by the end of this week. the Houston Astros. What a mess, a black eye, in my opinion, that they have made on Major League Baseball. But I also think, and I want more of your take than mine, but I also think that Major League Baseball hasn't helped itself out in kind of clearing up that black eye. But you're the baseball guy around here. I follow it to pretty decently, I guess. I'm a big Braves guy. Outside of that, I know the Stars. That's about it. I know the major players. But you've been following baseball practically all your life. What's your take on this whole thing with the Houston Astros and what's going on? We've already had one, probably the biggest name in the Houston Astros organization, and Jose Altuve got hit by a pitch. Now, they claim it was unintentional, hit him on the foot, but we've already had that. That's been a big expectation to come forward in the 2020 season. What's your take on this whole thing with the Houston Astros and Major League Baseball?
Well, first of all, I thought the timing when they released the study and the fact that they'd been caught cheating and all was very well-planned timing on Major League Baseball. They tried to sneak it in at a time where there was a lot of things going on where it didn't get the attention mm-hmm. that it needed to get, in my opinion, because they released it right around the Thanksgiving area. And, you know, you got the holidays, you got all the rivalries in college football, the National Football League is getting heated up as to who's going to make the Super Bowl, NBA is playing, the National Hockey League is playing. And I felt like when they released it that they were like trying to see if we can sweep this under the rug best we can.
Yeah.
I think it's a bigger scandal. And I wasn't alive in 1919, and my departed father was 2 years old and living in Dayton, Ohio, but talks about it because it was the talk of the world for about 10 years after that, the Black Sox scandal.
Yes.
Because when he was growing up and before he was becoming a teenager, that was still a black eye, even though the Cincinnati Reds were the recipient of the throwing of the World Series by the Chicago White Sox and all that stuff. It was still, the Reds were looked at with sort of a cocked eye, sort of the the rock eyebrow. And when they released the study or the investigation report that the Astros had been cheating and stealing signs and taping other teams and so forth and so on, when I first saw it, I was like, oh, geez, here we go. Because I thought it would blow up into something of a major scandal. And dadgummit, if it didn't sort of kind of get swept. Now, there was a lot of talk about it, and it made the talk shows and all that stuff. But it didn't get that attention that I thought it probably could have, would have, should have.
Yeah.
And now that spring training is in full swing, thank you, Jesus, thank you, Nick Saban, is high school basketball over with? Thank God.
Just about.
Thank you, Jesus. Too damn long of a season on that, too. But I think that there is there's so much pent-up frustration. And now that Major League ballplayers are getting to speak out for the first time, because they've been on holiday, they've been at rest, they've been on vacation. Now they're back, and the first thing reporters are going to ask them, what do you think about the Astros scandal? And they're teeing off on it, and rightly so.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, more so probably in Major League Baseball, I think, than any other pro sport, there's a lot of pride in the sport.
There is.
The NFL talks about protecting the shield. They can't hold a candle to the loyalty of Major League Baseball players to Major League Baseball. It's just one of those. It's just, if you got to play baseball, you get to make it to the show. It is forever ingrained in your soul, in your mind, in your body.
It's a different type of brotherhood.
And exactly. And the respect factor is extremely high.
Yeah.
And I think what we're seeing is the backlash of it. And I saw the first spring game on Saturday, and it was on the MLB network on DirecTV, that the Astros, and I want to say they played the Braves or the Phillies maybe, and they were playing at their home stadium down in Florida, and I think it's Winter Haven or whatever, and they came on the field to take the field and got booed by their own fans.
Yeah.
Booed by their own fans.
Yeah, they did. You bring up other players kind of throwing the shade at the Houston Astros. And again, I agree, rightfully so. But after that kind of started coming out, you heard some of the big name stars, and Mike Trout, for instance, he's sort of a guy that doesn't do a lot of talking when he's interviewed. He gives you a clip and he walks away. But all of a sudden now in the last couple of weeks, he's really started to talk and come out with his feelings on this, and rightfully so. I think as one of the major players in Major League Baseball right now, one of the absolute sequential superstars of the game. He has to have a voice in this. I think he should be voicing himself. All of a sudden, you turn around, and the Astro players are chirping right back now, and they're saying, well, you got the league has to protect us. The league, you got your hands caught in the cookie jar. Okay, that's just a fact. Now, let's not be pretentious enough to think that there's not sign stealing going on in every ball game.
Right.
It's been going on since the inception of the game and since signs started coming into the game. That's the way it is in every sport, in basketball, in football, and even hockey. You're looking for any way to get a leg up, but the way they've done it is what's so bad. And now they're chirping back. How do you feel about the Astros talking about Major League Baseball, Rod Manfred, you got to protect us, you got to keep us out of harm's way. If players are going to hit us, pitchers are going to hit us with the balls or anything else. I mean, what's your response to that? Because, I mean, I think it's kind of crazy that they think they have any right to start chirping back after they're the ones they got caught, and especially after a sorry excuse of a press conference to say, oops, we're sorry.
Well, a couple of things. I'd like to know, and I don't have the figure at hand. In fact, I'm looking it up right now. I'm trying to figure out how many players that are currently on the Astros roster were involved in the team that was caught with their hands in the cookie jar.
I still think a lot of them are still there.
So you think out of the 26-man roster, which, by the way, it's 26 men as of this year, do you think that it is still you think there's still a great number of players that are a part of that roster or a part of that team?
I do. I really do. I couldn't tell you all the names. Again, I mentioned Jose Altuve a little while ago. You know, they've got a new manager now in Dusty Baker after getting rid of the other guy, and which they should have. Of course, the manager up at the Boston Red Sox also ended up losing his job because he was a part of that as well.
Former second baseman for the Vanderbilt Commodores.
Yeah.
Joey Cora.
Yeah. So I do. I think that there are still sort of the core of the 2017 Astros still on this team upcoming. Whether they'll make the final cut or get sent down, I don't know. But because we're still in spring training. But, yes, I do think that most of the team is still there. I don't think that they've done anything with them.
Well, My read on this thing is that the players, okay, let's back up for a second. First of all, I think the reason I think the scandal is so huge and bad, it's a different thing if you're in, as players, when you play the game, you know, you may pick up on the second baseman is tipping off the catcher as to what the sign is coming from the dugout.
Mm-hmm.
And you read that and you watch people's mannerisms. But when you tape that, you put it on a VCR, you put it on the screen, you run it back and forth, and you catch every sign, and you write every sign out, and then you give it to all your ball team, to all your players. Okay, this is their bunt sign, this is their steal sign, this is a fastball on 2-0, blah, 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 blah. To me, that takes it to another realm. That's cheating.
Yeah.
You know, if you're watching and you get tipped off that every time the catcher or the pitcher goes to his cap, he's throwing you a curveball, that's picking up on something that is, you know, I think that's part of the playing of the game.
Yeah.
But when it comes and it becomes an electronic passion to steal every sign and to know every sign of every ball team in Major League Baseball, so when you go in to play them, you've got an advantage. That's cheating.
Yeah. Well, it's no different than watching the film of an offensive lineman and seeing the different types of stances that he makes and you picking up on, well, if he's in this type of stance, he's going to be –
he's
pass blocking. If he's in this stance, he's run blocking.
That's called scouting.
That's called doing your job and doing your due diligence. But exactly the way you described it, with going electronic with it not being so subtle about it, especially with garbage cans, for instance, I think is where you have majorly stepped across the line. The other thing I'll ask you about it, and then we'll move on with it, is your reaction to Rod Manfred, the Major League Baseball commissioner, and how he's handled this, basically coming out and saying, we're going to punish the organization, and we're going to punish those who are the top brass and those who are the managers and had anything to do with it that's any sort of manager style job there, but the players, on the other hand, they're off scot-free. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you have to punish the people that were guilty. And if the entire team was receiving information from the few that were perpetrating the stealing of the signs or whatever the case may be, and you were using that information, you're just as guilty.
Yeah.
So I would have preferred to have seen a 1-year ban in baseball for the Astros. Mm-hmm. I think they should have kept them from playing for an entire year. Now, who does that punish? Does it punish the players more than it punishes the city and the community and everything that goes along with it? Yes, it does, and that's unfortunate. But to me, that would be Major League Baseball's taking a drawing a line in the sand and taking a stance to saying, if we catch anybody doing this again, you're out of here for a year or maybe, you know, I hate to call it the death penalty because you saw what it did in college football to Southern Methodist University. It destroyed the college football at that university for 25 years. But in Major League Baseball, they wouldn't do that because the players union, I'm sure, would cover that. But I would think that that is, then all of a sudden, not only does Major League Baseball players and other teams take note, fans take note.
Right.
And people take note and say, hey, if our team's caught cheating, we ain't going to have a team for a year or two or three or whatever the case may be. And then the pressure is on not to cheat.
Right.
So that's my take on that.
Yeah. I sort of agree with that, although I might would let them play and maybe make it a postseason ban and say you will not be able to compete for the World Series. We're going to let you play, but your record is not going to count towards anything. It's not going to affect the standings. You will not be able to compete for the World Series, a pennant title. You might even put a ban on being able to play in the All-Star game or the Home Run Derby or the whatever else they've got going on in All-Star weekend. I know that they're turning that into a major thing now, but I wholeheartedly agree with everything that you've said. And really, I think that it's going to take some time in spite of the fact that some of this does feel like it's sort of been swept under the rug and had a, in my opinion, too swift of a reaction in the wrong way, mind you. But I sort of feel like this is going to be a black eye that sticks around for quite a while, not only because it's the Houston Astros, and every time you turn on the TV to watch them play, like your Cincinnati Reds or my Atlanta Braves or whatever, you're going to think about that. But I think just in general, it has sparked something that a lot of teams that – because I guarantee you, they're not coming out and saying it, but I guarantee you other teams have thought about doing it or they started doing it and they've had to back off.
Honestly, Adam, I think teams have probably been doing it for many years and didn't get caught because they weren't as blatant with it as the Astros were.
Yeah.
I just think that's the case. Speaking of that, and we always talk about subjects other than sports, but I got to bring one up. And this was something that I am not going to pay. This is the statement I'll make and we'll go from there. But the other night, there was a major prize fight, a professional boxing heavyweight championship of the world between Tyson Fury and Deontay Wilder. By the way, I should be his PA guy, but anyway, another story for another day. I wanted to see the fight. There was enough interest in the fight. And being a former wrestling, in fact, I'm on a wrestling podcast tonight after we finish our podcast, a worldwide podcast tonight, talking about the old territory days in Nashville and Chattanooga and Louisville and so forth with that. But and that's a video chat that's going to be on YouTube, and we'll let you know where you can watch that. But getting back to this, I said, okay, I want to see this fight. I figured, okay, $49.95 is normally what they charge for a pay-per-view. I'll call Lee Masters. I'll call Chad Sanders. He likes boxing. Well, two or three of us guys that gets boxing. If I get three or four guys over, two or three guys over, we're going to watch the boxing, and I pay $49 for it. I sort of get that. That's a night of entertainment, and you're at your house, and you're watching it, and, you know, the whole nine yards, and everything's fun. $79.95 for that. And I was like, I really want to see this fight, but I ain't paying $79.95 to buy a ticket to sit on my own couch.
Yeah.
Now, if I'm going to pay $80 for a ticket, I better go to an arena. I want to eat some popcorn. I want to drink a Coca-Cola. I want to feel the crowd. I want to have some fun.
Yeah.
Okay. Sort of kind of see that. I ain't paying $80 to sit at home on my bum, on my couch, to watch my TV. And a prize fight that ended up being a squash and a work.
Yeah. So you think about it the same way that I used to think about before SEC Network came along, before all these other TV deals came along. Alabama, Auburn, all these other teams used to have one game a year. Now, it was generally a nasty up cupcake game, but they had one game a year that would be on pay-per-view, and it would be like $60 to $80. And I'm going, there's no way I'm missing that. I'm just going to end up missing that one. I'll listen to Eli on the radio while I'm shopping or whatever I'm going to do. I'm not paying $60, $80 to sit on my rump when I can travel 3 hours down to watch the game and pay $20 to get in. You think about the fight the same way I do. I wasn't even thinking about having friends over. I don't have a lot of friends that are into the boxing scene. I enjoy it occasionally, especially when it's a guy like somebody like Deontay Wilder, or a big fight like it was built up to be in Tyson Fury and Wilder. But I'm like you. I'm not going to just haul off and whip the wallet out for $80, especially for a fight that is really totally one-sided from the get-go.
And you're talking to a guy that has both Dish Network and DirecTV at his new TV home. Of course, Dish Network we have at the station. I just happen to have a receiver at home. And DirecTV I have as a personal since 1996. But you just have to draw the line somewhere.
Yeah, you do. What about the fight in particular, though? I told you earlier in the week that I was keeping up with it mainly via Twitter. I would update probably every 30 seconds because, you know, you and I both know in other sports, it can take 5 minutes for something to change. But in boxing, because of the nature of the beast, something can change in a matter of seconds. And so I'm over here going, I really want to know. Deontay Wilder comes from my favorite place on earth, Tuscaloosa. A lot of people think I'm crazy for that. I love Tuscaloosa, but I wanted
Alabama's
to keep up
own
with it.
Personal cesspool.
There you are. I wanted to keep up with it, though, and that was my way of doing it. And, of course, I'd catch a clip every now and then. Somebody would video their TV and upload it or something, and I'd see, like, for instance, oh, my gosh, Tyson Fury licking the blood off his neck. Ugh, that's gross.
Let's take this from another angle. having been in the wrestling business and started in the wrestling business in 1978, professionally, being paid to be in the professional wrestling business as an announcer, I worked for a gentleman named Nick Gulas. Nick Gulas is a famous name in the Southeast. He was the booker, the promoter for professional wrestling in Tennessee, Alabama, and Kentucky, part of Indiana, and a little bit of Mississippi for many, many years, for over 50 years. And when I got to know Nick, he was in his early 70s, and I went to work for him, and I could do the play-by-play and the commentary. I'd known enough wrestling. Back then, wrestling was a bunch of holds. And if you knew the Greco-Roman style, you knew the holds, you could call the match. And I did it with a flurry like I do football. As if I were calling a football game, I'm calling a wrestling match. And Mr. Nick liked that. So I was permanently hired at a very good, thanks to Mr. Nick, my daughter was paid for to come into this world. Without him, I don't know, I'd probably still owe. But we were on a trip. In 1980, Harry Thornton, who was the play-by-play man for wrestling on the TV station Channel 12 in Chattanooga, older guy, had a morning show, just like Grady Reeves in Huntsville was on WHNT, was the wrestling commentator, had a morning show. Sterling Brewer was the wrestling commentator in Birmingham on Channel 42. He had an advertising agency, so forth. Lance Russell and Dave Brown. Lance was a TV program director at Channel 13 in Memphis. Dave Brown was the weatherman there. They did the Memphis TV and Louisville TV. Well, later did Louisville TV after I did. But anyway, we're on our way to a Saturday television taping in Chattanooga. Harry Thornton had a heart attack, and Mr. Nick had asked me to fill in for him every week for what ended up to be about 4 months. Until Harry came back, and then Nick sold the territory, and then we started taping everything on Wednesday night in Nashville and bicycling the tape, meaning it was sent to all the TV stations a week after it was taped. But anyway, we're in Mr. Nick's car, and he's driving down, as he always did, God rest his soul, the middle of I-24. He would be a four-lane highway to Chattanooga between Nashville, and he would take the middle line and put it in the middle of his car and drive to Chattanooga. Mm-hmm. We didn't drive the right lane or the left lane. We drove the middle. We did get stopped a couple of times by police people, by state troopers that recognized him, wanting tickets to a show or asking him to say hello to their granddaughter on TV or something. It was really funny. But we were going to Chattanooga, and there was a boxing match that was coming up with Ali and, I'm trying to remember. It may have been Foreman. It was coming up, and I'm a big Ali, as you know, a very, very big. I've studied Muhammad Ali. I never got to meet him personally, but got his autograph. Never got to shake his hand or get my picture taken. But he was always a hero to me growing up. He was one of those childhood hero kind of things. So we're talking about the fight, and Mr. Nick driving, and he turns to me at about 90 miles an hour. And he says, you know, kid, boxing's a bigger work than wrestling. What? You know, I knew how the wrestling game, I mean, I was in the dressing room. I was passing finishes back between the boys, between the dressing rooms. I knew on a Thursday what we were doing on, or rather on a Tuesday, what we were doing Wednesday night so I could prepare to tell the story. And to me, I had never watched boxing as being a, where the outcome was already determined before the match began.
Right.
It does not happen in your small matches or your non-big money matches. But he convinced me over the period of about a half an hour that the promoters, the money people, the television people, the pay-per-view people, figure out what's going to draw the money, what fights are going to draw the money. And then they're going to make the other fights leading up to that fight promote the pinnacle of that event.
Uh-huh.
Perfect example of this fight. Why did Tyson Fury win the fight? Well, I, in my, and from following the following the breadcrumbs down the trail, they wanted the, first of all, there's another guy named Chafin or something in England that is the heavyweight champion in three of four. Of
Joshua
four,
something.
Yeah, but boxing, three of four of the boxing, quote-unquote, companies in the world. He is the heavyweight champion of the world, and he's a very good fighter. Tyson Fury is from England. The first fight was a dull, it was a draw, but to most people that saw the first fight, they felt Fury had won.
Anthony Joshua.
Anthony Joshua. Okay. So this fight, they had to get the belt off of Deontay Wilder, the WBA belt off of Wilder, onto Fury to do a major pay-per-view at Wimbledon Stadium that will be $100 million-plus on pay-per-view for the quote-unquote unification of the heavyweight championship of the world. And that's what this was. So they had to beat Deontay Wilder to bring the bigger money, the biggest money draw, for these four organizations to split at the end of the payoff. And they had to make it happen to where it's Englishman on Englishman.
Hmm.
And that's what's setting up. Will there be a return with Fury? I think there'll be a return with Fury before or after the Joshua Fury fight. Deontay Wilder will then challenge to win the unified heavyweight championship of the world. And we'll go from there. And again, big money. I had a wrestler tell me, I tweeted that out. I had a wrestler that came back immediately, and then Jimmy Cornette came back immediately and said the same thing. If it's on TV and fighting is involved, it's going to be a work.
The fix is in.
The fix is in.
Yeah. You're listening to the Fun and Then Some podcast. Adam Ward alongside Michael St. John. We're talking Tyson and Wilder right now. And one thing that if you haven't followed the news, Deontay Wilder, from the hospital that evening, had already made it known that he is going to invoke his rematch clause for the third round, the Fury-Wilder round three, the trilogy, whatever you want to call it. And they do expect that fight to happen sometime either late this summer or possibly a little bit later on in the year, which very well could set up your theory about a fight between Fury and Anthony Joshua over
in the meantime
in Britain or wherever they end up wanting to hold that. I'm sure it will be somewhere like Wimbledon or someplace like that. But he has already said that it was in the contract that if that whichever fighter won, albeit Fury in this case, the loser can invoke a third fight, a rematch fight. And that's exactly what Wilder has done. What do you make of him coming out and saying that, you know, first of all, he said it ringside before he even left, that his legs just didn't feel right. They were wobbly. They were weak. And then came out a little bit later and said it was because of that 45-pound suit of armor that he came out wearing. First of all, I think the whole thing is just a I don't like the suit armor. I get it. It's supposed to be cool. He can do it. He's rich. Whatever he wants to do, whatever. But I'm kind of like, eh. You could have done without it, first of all. But what do you make of that whole, I was weak because of this thing that I did, business? I mean, what do you think of that?
I was counting on Wilder's right hand to dominate and win the fight. I thought he would blow up Fury with the right hand because, to me, next to Ali, he has the most powerful punch that I've seen in boxing. And so I don't think, and I think because how I was thinking is probably how Deontay Wilder's handlers and corner was thinking.
Uh-huh.
He's going to throw a big haymaker. He's going to blow him up. He's going to have the opportunity. Fury is not a fighter. He's a fighter, not a boxer. We're going to get in. He's going to have the opening. Boom. One time, pow. One time, down. Out. Over. Game over. Didn't work that way.
No.
To that extreme, if that was the way they were thinking to prepare for the Wilder fight, and by the way, it's Wembley Stadium, and I just got corrected, and it's not Wimbledon, that's where they play tennis.
Yeah.
But at Wembley Stadium in London, he trained that way. I think he trained that way.
Yeah.
And with that in mind, I don't think he was prepared defensively to fight a fighter that's a fighter, not a boxer, mm-hmm. like Tyson Fury or any other. You know, he would have lost, in my opinion, to Joe Frazier or Iron Mike Tyson in the same way he lost Saturday. And he got the crap beat out of him.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, we said, Michael, you just said boxing was a work. No, I said the outcome is a work. They still hit each other.
Yeah.
They got to hit each other. It's boxing.
Yeah.
But he got the crap beat out of him. And when a fighter gets the crap beat out of him in a big fight, that means they haven't been preparing for what the fight brought on. Fury came in at 30 pounds heavier and just went after him like a bull in a china shop, like a tank, and destroyed him. I don't know. I don't care if it's a suit or armor or a negligee. He'd have still gotten beat because it was the way he trained, not what he wore to the ring.
Right. Made that the left ear bleed. What was it? The third round, the camera's got a really good shot of that left ear bleeding. And of course, everybody blew up. His eardrum's busted. Something's broken. They got to throw in the towel. They got to throw in the fight. And, of course, that's exactly what they ended up doing a little bit later on. Wilder's corner throwing in the towel. Wilder not happy about it. Ringside having an argument with his corner.
Well.
But.
Wilder was beat in the second round.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw the replay. I've seen the replay since the fight. And in my opinion, in my professional eye on this, he was done after the second round.
Right.
He was done after the second round. He wasn't prepared for the fight.
Right.
Speaking of which, and speaking of fights and non-fights, here on the Remember Then and Some podcast.
Yeah.
Remember and Then Some podcast. I put it in the Citizen Bill vernacular. Mm-hmm. Remember Then.
We'll have to get him on here sometime.
Yeah. But first of all, I want to thank, we've had several people listen and comment back to us, and we thank you for giving us an ear. But we want to welcome in, thanks to Melanie St. John, our first advertiser that in future to shows we will actually be talking with and talking to at some point. And it's a very outstanding advertiser, our friends at Jerry Damson Ford.
Yeah. Yeah, old Ben Bowles over there, he and that crew over there have done a fantastic job. But we've had a great working relationship with them now for several years. And, of course, you and I, one of the first goals we were talking about before we even sat down to record even a test episode, if you will, was we want to build this up and get some sponsors in. And of course, one of the first names to pop up was Ben Bowles and Jerry Damson Ford. And, you know, like you mentioned, Miss Melanie went down there, had a chat with them and came in the office the other day and was just kind of grinning about it. And she said, it's working out. We're going to make this work. So, welcome aboard. And, you know, I look forward to, cause I'm a Ford guy, first of all. So I tend to, every time I go down that way, I tend to kind of give a quick look, see as to what's on the lot. I look forward to having conversations with them in the near future, talking about what they've got going on as well. And, of course, just us helping each other out. I think it's going to be wonderful.
I'd be interested in all the new Fandangle stuff that's coming on automobiles starting now in the 2020 models and now the 2021 models right around the corner. There's so much new innovation coming to automobiles. You know, they're talking about ones that pock themselves. You saw the commercial in the Super Bowl, the Kapok.
My favorite.
And you saw it, and there's so many of these innovations coming. Basically, what's on your cell phone and your homepage of your cell phone becomes the homepage of your dash at your car. There's so much going on with the vehicles. I'm looking forward to talking a little bit about I'm not a car guy, but I am looking forward because I'm a gadget guy on cars. So I want to know what the new gadgets are.
Yeah.
So we'll look forward to talking. And of course, Jerry Damson Ford is a bridge and a few feet from Huntsville. But if you're looking for a buy, they can save you a lot of money when you come to Highway 231 in AREB and shop our friends at Jerry Damson Ford. You know, Jerry Damson and my grandfather were very good friends in the Elks Club in Huntsville back in the 60s and 70s. And Mr. Damson was a young man then. They'd play cards at the Elks Club on Sunday afternoon and on Tuesday nights, and I can't tell you how many times I got to know Jerry Dampson walking into Pawpaw's house, and he'd be bringing Pawpaw home, and we'd invite him in, and he'd sit, watch a little TV and chit-chat, and a wonderful businessman. And if anybody has done such a marvelous job of creating a car empire in North Alabama and doing it the right way, the fair way, and doing it the way that the people like, they treat people the way you want to be treated, and they give you the deals that you want to do, he's done a great job with it.
Yeah, I think so. Let's leave the folks with a wonderful kind of, I guess you could say a little bit inspirational, but a very unique story here that I did want to bring out. I had heard about this, and I thought, there's no way that can't be real. But I also thought, well, it's on a nationally syndicated radio show. I'm hearing about this, so there's got to be something to it. And I wanted to catch your eye on this. I don't know if you had heard about this.
Go for it, Kobe.
Yeah. How old are you?
How old am I?
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
You're 60s. Okay, we'll say it like that.
I'm 68.
Okay.
A young 68.
According to
68 from the navel up.
According to the BBC News, the world planking record has been set by an ex-Marine at 62 years old.
What is planking?
Okay, planking is a form, it's like fitness. It's something to do, and to be honest, I couldn't do this. As I understand it, it's basically almost like laying on the floor or something on your stomach and trying to go as stiff as a board as you can. And it's supposed to like stretch your muscles and all this sort of thing. And I don't
sort of like waterboarding.
But a 62-year-old former U.S. Marine veteran in Chicago, which is where I was born, broke the world planking record with a time of, get this, 8 hours, 15 minutes, and 15 seconds. This, according to the Guinness World Book of Records.
What a stiff.
Yeah. Think about that for a moment. The previous record was set by, and I'm going to get this wrong, Mao Weidong in China in 2016.
Weidong?
Yeah, Weidong. I'm probably saying that wrong, but the record set, it'll actually be listed in the Guinness World Book of Records for the longest male abdominal plank, I said that wrong too, in Chicago. And he finished the
abdominal
event.
Abdominal be snowman.
Yeah. And he finished it, by the way, I did not know this. I'm reading this now for the first time. He finished it off after he broke the record by doing 75 push-ups at the end of it.
Wow.
Can you do that?
No.
Could you?
Do I want to do that? No.
Could you imagine doing something like that, though?
No.
I mean, really?
No.
When I heard that story earlier in the week, I thought, okay, well, you know, the guy's probably like 45. He's probably a fitness nut, you know, kind of deal, and that's all he does is eat nuts and berries and plank. But no, when they said he's 62 years old, he's a Marine vet, I'm going, okay, the Marine part explains a little bit of the fitness, but it's 62 years old?
That's good. You know, one of the things, and it's funny you bring that up, and that is very interesting from my, and the first thing I think about is, what does he eat that keeps him healthy?
Yeah.
Furniture? I mean, what does he eat? So much of our body's deterioration over our lifetime is not from things we are doing to ourselves, but from our external influences.
Yeah.
The first bad one is gravity.
Yeah.
That kills your body more than anything else that we suffer in this world. When you're born, the first thing that starts getting to your body is gravity, believe it or not. And after that, everything that is put in food product and byproducts that are put into foodstuffs that even our forefathers and perhaps even as soon as our grandfathers and grandmothers didn't have to worry about until after World War II.
Yeah. So this man is George Hood. He did 2,100 hours of planking in preparation for this. He began training back in 2011 and would train for 7 hours a day to do this event. Quote, he would totally disassociate himself from the reality of the clock, and he says it's an art and a skill set that he has mastered over the years. Now, and here's what planking is, by the way. I'm sort of right on that, except it's not on the gut. You're laying sort of like, if you can imagine, it's almost like a push-up, but instead of using your hands, you're on your elbows, and you're staying straight as you can from the tip of your toes to your elbows, and your elbows are out sort of in front of you. Mm. Sort of like you're laying down making a touchdown symbol like a referee does. So imagine laying on your elbows like that for 8 hours, 15 minutes, 15 seconds.
Not me, white boy.
No, not me. So congratulations to George Hood. You ever hear this? Congratulations. Folks, if that don't tell you something that even at 62, a lot of things are still possible in this world that you can be able to do. It's just a matter of mind. It's a mindset thing, I would think.
And we'll finish up about mindset. And I don't know how many people got to see the entire Kobe Bryant memorial service the other day. I unfortunately did not get to see all of it, but I've seen enough of it to think I put the pieces together and I've seen just about all of it. And, you know, I talked to our good friend Steve Sudbury, who is our partner with WTNK Fund 93.5 FM in Hartsville, Tennessee. He got all hot and bothered when I, what are you watching that crap for? Those basketball players, blah, blah, blah. He's never been a basketball player. Well, he did play basketball, but was not bad at it. But he's a big hockey guy, and that's okay. He's, you know, and he's a football guy, and that's cool. Mm-hmm. But I think this whole Kobe Bryant thing, and he says, oh, it's been blown out of proportions, this and that. I think that forget the fact he was a basketball, but take the ball out of Kobe Bryant life. Yeah. And think about him as the person, the man, the leader, the example, the father. I think it's good for society, and I think it was good for our country to see this kind of event. Terrible, tragic situation to cause this event to have to be had or to take place. But I think from our country standpoint, it is a good thing to see what love and respect and fatherhood and brotherhood is all about. Because I have my biggest problem with our world today is our young people that are being raised in a society, the majority of them without a total family unit.
Yep.
A great deal of them with a single parent or a kin person or sometimes just a friend raising them or allowing them to stay in their house or their abode. And for what we are teaching in schools, and this is no slap at our teachers, and I love all of our teachers. I admire every one of you. But I think our curriculum that we're teaching is so far away from what our society has become that it is laughable. We are not teaching our kids how to communicate. I've told the story before on this podcast. I've told it on the radio. I've told it to a million different people. Melanie and I were at a restaurant in Nashville a few weeks ago when we were up at our station up there. We were having dinner out in the Hendersonville area. Two people walked in. It was a date night. They were off on Friday. It was a Thursday night. They were off on Friday. They walk in, probably juniors or seniors in high school, well-dressed, polite-mannered people, sat down in the booth next to us. And as we were having our meal and our conversation and so forth, those kids didn't talk to each other one time.
Right.
They talked to the waitress and ordered their meal, and they looked at each other and they smiled. You could tell they were on a date. But they were sitting there with their home devices in their hand, their phone or iPad or whatever it was, texting to each other, not talking to each other, texting to each other on a date in a restaurant. What the? I'm sorry. Communication is one-on-one. It's person-to-person, eye contact to eye contact, body language to body language. That's part of what we as human beings are allowed by the grace of God. And to me, communication skills is one of the most important skill you can have in life, next to breathing, period.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, too, I didn't get to watch it in real time. I have since gone back and taken the time to watch it. I had already seen clips beforehand. First of all, I think it sort of provided an opportunity, first of all, for a city like L.A. to sort of come together to give each other a big hug, to kind of collectively breathe a minute, and to just air it out, to just air the grievances, let the emotions just flow for a time together. Now, I know that a bunch of people had been gathering outside the arena for several weeks now since the passing of Kobe and Gigi and the seven others. but I think this was an opportunity for them to sort of also not only be, you know, the local people gathering, but also be right there with these other, I hate to say celebrities, but that's what they really are, like Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson. Even a young teenager from the Oregon women's basketball team was there, who was a friend of Kobe's. Got to speak on the Bryant's behalf. I felt like that was just a time that was really just needed, if not so much as to pay the respects and everything for the 9 victims lost, but just to be able to gather, to breathe, and just to talk, just to let it out, instead of saying and texting, "Hey, I'm here for you if you need anything." You know, that's all well and good to a certain extent, but we as human beings, we need somebody to look us in the eye more times than we care to admit and say, "It's going to be okay, that I love you, I'm here for you." When things are hurting, things are not looking so good, things are bad, whatever it might be, we don't, you know, it's fine to be able to look at our phone and see somebody's reached out via a text, but it's a whole different meaning when somebody will actually take the time to come to you and even just to look at you in the eye and say, "Hey, I love you. I'm praying for you. If you need, do you need anything? Let me help you." And I sort of felt like the epitome of that was when Vanessa, Kobe's wife, got up to speak. My gosh. First of all, her strength. In light of the circumstance, losing both a husband and one of her daughters. But the fact of she hasn't really been totally vocal about anything in person. She's made a few remarks via, you know, social media and things of that nature. But for her to be able to come out and overwhelmingly show her love and even her support back to the community at large that has tried to support her as best they can, I thought was very well done. But I will say the thing that got me was when she mentioned the fact that she has a daughter. I didn't know this, that she has a daughter getting married in September.
Mm-hmm.
And now she's going to be the one to walk her down the aisle because her daddy can't.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't make, you know, you were talking about the family unit. If you are, and I'm going to be bold and I'm going to say this, and people might not like it, I don't care. If you are a father in particular, I'm going to speak to the fathers. I am not one, so it's a little bit hard sometimes to speak to a father. But if you're a father and you don't have much of a relationship with your kids, or you don't have one at all, you need to do some rethinking who you are. You need to rethink what those kids really need. And if you are a father and you think you might be doing enough, I can straight up tell you, you can always do better. I mean, that's plausible in everything you do in life. It can always be better. But I just think about it like, if I had a daughter, man, one of my goals in life would always be to make sure I stuck around long enough to walk her down that aisle. And now there's a daughter that's not going to be able to have that opportunity to have her daddy next to her walking her down. My wife, for instance, when we got married, wanted both mom and dad. Mm-hmm. And she got it. And she loved it. You know, that's something special. So I think Vanessa really kind of, you know, brought it all together when she showed her strength to stand up, to speak to not only the crowd, the 20,000 people in Staples Center, but Michael, she was talking to the world.
Mm-hmm.
In that moment. How awesome. How crazy is that? And if we can't follow that suit, then we got a bigger problem than what I even thought.
Well, you know, Kobe Bryant may have been the star when he was alive, but the strength of that family, and I think you saw it,
mm-hmm.
was the wife.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky I have that same situation in my relationship. And along with some baggage, but that's another story. I think that's very well put. But I just wanted to bring that out, that for us as a society of civilized human beings, it wasn't about basketball. It was about coming together to grieve and to share stories and to cleanse and to share philosophy, which I think was tantamountly done.
Yep.
You mentioned Los Angeles, and having lived in Los Angeles for almost 5 years and not having lived in New York, but in the New York area for over a year within the perimeter of the city. There's a big difference between LA and New York.
Mm-hmm.
And you may have heard me say this. I've said this before on the radio, but I've also said it a lot in personal conversation. In New York, there's 10 million people on an island in five boroughs of nationalities, race, color, creed, national origin, sexual persuasion, different religions. It makes no difference. And because they're all on a little bit of land, they're on like a 90 square mile patch of land, they all sort of kind of get together and get along.
Yeah.
They have their differences, but, you know, and you have some weirdos getting crazy on different sects and groups and facts, you know. And that's New York. But when you got 10 million people, you're going to have some folks like that. But they sort of kind of all get along. And when you're in New York and you stay in the city or you stay out on Long Island or you stay in one of the boroughs, you sort of get a camaraderie feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And all you got to do in New York is mention the Yankees and everybody's your friend. In Los Angeles, you've got 5,000 square miles with 10 million people of race, color, creed, and national origin from all points of the globe, from all nationalities and religions and faiths, all walks of life, and none of them get along.
Yeah.
And having lived there, you witness it daily. There's a, and I don't know if it is the fact that it is, it takes you an hour and a half to go 2.5 miles on the freeway to get to work. I don't know what the situation is as to why exactly it is. But in LA, the riots and the problems you've seen in Los Angeles are not just born of Los Angeles for no reason.
Right.
It is the makeup of the area. And the only time that Los Angeles ever comes together is when there's a disaster or a major star
mm-hmm.
is involved in a crisis or a death, i.e. we were out there and living when the O.J. Simpson, we were in a Mexican restaurant a half a block from the freeway where the white Bronco passed by and everybody was blowing their horns and waving and saying, oh, hey, it's O.J., when he was on the run, when he was on the lam in the valley. And in Los Angeles, that's the earthquake. Went through the earthquake in 94 out there. Los Angelians, that's their gravity point. That's their come together point.
Yeah.
In New York, you don't have to have that because you already are come together. And when there is a major disaster or crisis in New York, everybody jumps on board to help.
Yep.
In L.A., and I said this about the tornadoes here in 2011, when the tornadoes happened in North Alabama in 2011, we witnessed it. We were on the air within 55 minutes of the tornado crossing 231 and stayed on the air 6 days and six nights with coverage. First thing you saw were people in pickup trucks with generators and chainsaws and their best buddies piled into the truck going hither, there, and yon to help anybody they can. Get out of their house, get trees off their yard, get trees off their car, help them find food, find water, whatever the case may be. And we saw that over and over and over. In L.A., in the 94 earthquake, the earthquake happened, and everybody sat on their butts waiting for somebody from the government to come and help them. In New York, when the hurricane came up the eastern seaboard, it was almost the same thing. You would see film from L.A. in the earthquake and film from New York from Hurricane Sandy and see people standing out, walking around, doing whatever, but you didn't hear the chainsaws and you didn't see the pickup trucks
mm-hmm.
and you didn't see eight guys you've never met or seen ever before in your front yard trying to chop down a tree so you could get out of your door.
Right.
It doesn't happen.
Right.
And from that, to me, that's something that we in the South have that I pray to God never, ever, ever goes away.
Yeah. I don't think it will. I really don't. Just speaking personally, I can remember April 27th very well because I had a friend who was involved. His father, their roof collapsed, and his father, trying to save his family, ended up having a beam fall on him. He ended up in the hospital, had to have surgery to repair his back. And I can remember trying to help clear the house out, and as I would walk through, we didn't end up having to use a bunch of tools. We were able to do a lot of it by hand, but I do remember folks would come around in their trucks, and I'm not talking about FEMA or anybody like that. I'm talking regular Joes who just happened to be driving by, saw a house that was destroyed, and pulled up to say, "Hey, can I help you guys? I got chains in the back. I've got chainsaws. I can get a bulldozer over here. I can get whatever we need to do." And you know, a lot of it was, "We're good. We can handle this. Go help somebody else that needs it." You know, because there are more people that's hurting worse than this. So I remember that very well, and I think it's very well put in that. I think that's sort of unique to the South versus anywhere else. Now, I've done a lot of traveling, haven't done a lot of living anywhere else, but I've done a lot of traveling, and I can sort of just see it in the attitude and the faces of other people. You know, for instance, I went back to Chicago last May for a few days, and what's normal down here is when you're passing by a car, you kind of wave at them as you pass them. I would do that, and nobody even would wave back. You'd look at somebody and they'd give you that "why are you looking at me" look. So I can see an attitude difference even from here to there that I think is very unique, and I think it kind of gets personified in the event of a disaster, i.e. April 27th or even in New York and 9/11, you know, that kind of situation there. But I think it's very well put. I think that I don't think it is something that ever will go away. I really don't. I think it's here until the Lord decides to come back, take us home, and plunge this earth into a new age. I really do.
Well, but I pray that you are correct, and I will say this, and you can quote me, and I've been quoted, and I this is my quote, and I really, truly, in my heart, believe this. We have national championship football teams in Alabama and in the South because of national championship people.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And then you don't get to see those national championship people. Well, you get to see them every day, but you don't realize why they are national championship people until there is an event where we all come together in the South.
Yeah, I agree with you. And folks, if you're tuning in, we appreciate you tuning in. You are a national champion in your own right just for tuning in. We want you to tell your friends about us. It's the Fun and Then Some podcast. And, of course, we're going to have a lot of fun. Jerry Dampson, again, coming on with us, going to be one of the sponsors of this podcast. If you own a business and you want to get in on this as well, you can do that by giving us a phone call. You can also email us. You can email melanie@fun927.com, or you can even get in touch with me at production@fun927.com. That phone number, let me give that to you right quick, is 256-531-9927. Give us a call. We'd like to get you involved on that. You can speak with myself, Michael St. John, Melanie St. John, or somebody in particular, anybody you want. We'll get you involved on it on the Fun and Then Some podcast. Again, we thank you for tuning in. For Michael St. John, I am Adam Ward. Hope you have a wonderful time. We'll talk to you next time on the Fun and Then Some podcast from Fun Radio, Fun 92.7 FM.